Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on the challenges the U.S. Army is facing in finding young Americans who are in good enough physical condition to serve.
The same issues that the way they're impacting America's overall quality of life, competitiveness in a global economy, and other things.
Then we report on a debate within the Army about possibly letting some soldiers who fight wars on computers to be heavier than soldiers who are fighting on the battlefield. As we will hear, not everyone supports such a change. The U.S. Army's recruiting challenges and possible changes to weight standards for the Army's new cyber warriors. Those are our stories today on As It Is. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a daily podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have ended, and Congress has ordered the military to reduce troop levels. But the United States Army and other military services must continue to recruit new soldiers, and it is having trouble finding enough people who are qualified. The Army tells VOA changes in society have decreased the number of young people who are eligible to join. The U.S. Army plans to reduce its size from 508,000 soldiers to 450,000 by the year 2017. Most new soldiers leave the service after their first enlistment period of 3 or 4 years has ended. So the Army must still recruit between 70,000 and 90,000 young Americans every year to reach its target troop level. People who want to join the Army must be in good physical and mental condition. They must be between the ages of 17 and 34. They must have graduated from high school. They must not have used illegal drugs or have a criminal record. And they may have only small tattoos and none on their hands, face, neck, or head. The Department of Defense says 71% of young Americans between the ages of 17 and 24 would not be accepted into one of the nation's military services if they volunteered. The Army believes that number will increase to 80% by 2020, mostly because of the expected rise in obesity levels. The Army says about 28% of people who apply are rejected because they are overweight or have behavior problems. Others are not permitted to join because they have a criminal record or a history of drug abuse. Some are rejected because they are unable to meet the military's academic requirements. One quarter of the high school graduates who take the Army's math and reading test fail it. Major General Alan Bachelet is the commander of the U.S. Army's Recruiting Command. He spoke to the public radio program Here and Now in August about the Army's recruiting difficulties. He says the main problem is young Americans' poor physical fitness.
The factors that we use to measure and evaluate people to join the Army, increasingly, they're not able to meet those requirements. And it's very troubling, and the trends are not in a good direction, especially in regards to fitness. Young people are showing up at our doors increasingly unfit or obese, and it's a real problem.
The U.S. Army reflects the nature of the country's youth, and many young Americans are simply too fat to fight. General Bachelet says he is worried the Army will soon be unable to reach its recruiting goals. He says the country's current social trends may be creating a serious national security problem. You are listening to As It Is on The Voice of America. The U.S. Army needs cyber warriors to defend against attacks on the nation's computer systems. But it is having a hard time finding young Americans who meet all of the requirements for the job. Cyber warrior candidates must have advanced computer skills, want to join the service, and meet the Army's current physical fitness standards. So the Army is studying whether it should have different height and weight standards for soldiers depending on what job they will do. The possible change could permit cyber warriors, soldiers who fight the enemy in cyberspace, to have more body fat than soldiers who fight on the battlefield. Now, all soldiers must meet the same physical standards, whether they are cooks, clerks, or infantrymen. To remain in the Army, male soldiers between the ages of 17 and 21 must be able to do 35 push-ups and 47 sit-ups. They must also run 2 miles in fewer than 17 minutes. Female soldiers of the same age must reach similar timed targets for push-ups, sit-ups, and a 2-mile run. Major General Alan Bachelet leads the U.S. Army Recruiting Command. The Florida Times Union newspaper reported his comments about possible changes to the Army's standards for some new soldiers. The newspaper said General Bachelet believes people who are fighting a war in cyberspace may not need to meet the same physical standards as infantrymen. They must still be physically fit, healthy, and have a professional appearance, however. But many young Americans are obese and do not exercise much. Many of them are likely to struggle or fail to pass the Army's physical fitness test without training. General Bachelet did not say how the test might be changed to permit those who cannot pass it, but who have the computer skills the Army needs, to join the military. Beth Ash is a senior economist at the RAND Corporation, a research group. She studies military recruiting activities. She told VOA that new missions have always forced the Army to study different recruiting methods.
A few years ago, this issue came up in the context of language capability, that people who had language capability wouldn't necessarily meet other requirements. And the issue there was that people who have language capabilities in the languages we really needed weren't necessarily U.S. citizens or would have passed security clearance-related issues. So these are smaller-scale programs that were very targeted to a specific need, and the idea was these people would help meet that need.
The Army told VOA that officials have only talked about possible policy changes. They have not made a decision about changing standards for possible new cyber warriors. A spokesman said, "The Army works in deliberate, careful ways on issues like this, so we don't believe a change will be made soon. That's our program for today. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
The Technology Report is next, followed by This is America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report.
For years, robots have helped doctors perform operations with greater safety, speed, and exactness than by using hand-controlled instruments. Now, one such machine reduces the time it takes to make dental crowns. This procedure can repair a damaged tooth in just about 2 hours. Years ago, several long visits to the dentist were required to manufacture a dental crown. And between visits, the patient had to wear a temporary crown, a small hat-like cover that encircles the tooth. During that period, a technician prepares a permanent replacement. Since the 1980s, robotic machines have greatly speeded up that procedure. Sitting in the dentist chair takes far less time than it once did. Michael Silvius has a dental office in Northern Virginia, near Washington, D.C. He describes the time saved.
12 minutes worth of chair time for the patient. The rest of the time, it's work that's taking place outside the patient's mouth.
Dr. Silvius and his assistant are preparing a patient's tooth for a new crown. The drilling inside the patient's mouth lasts about 5 minutes. In the past, a plastic material was used to make an impression of the damaged tooth. But now, Dr. Silvius uses a video camera on a wand to inspect the tooth and the surrounding area. Next, a computer takes over the process. It designs the new crown and creates directions for a robotic milling machine. A small cube of porcelain is placed between two drills, similar to the one the dentist uses. The porcelain is no larger than the tooth. The high-speed tools break off extra material from the cube, creating a perfectly shaped tooth crown. To harden, the crown must be heated for about 10 minutes. During that process, its color is changed to the color of the patient's other teeth. Then, the dental crown is ready to be placed permanently in the patient's mouth.
It feels amazing. The tooth feels like my tooth.
Many people wearing crowns will say the newer procedure is a huge improvement over older methods. But Dr. Silvius says even this technology may someday become obsolete.
The other thing you really look forward to is genetic engineering and eventually cloning so that you can make the crown out of actually enamel, just like the patient's natural teeth are.
For now, Dr. Silvius says his patients are happy to be able to get a new crown in just one visit.
And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to This is America from VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Kelly Jean Kelly. This week on our program, we look at the history of the White House, the president's home in Washington, D.C.
When America's first president, George Washington, entered office in 1789, the nation's capital was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But Washington and other lawmakers agreed to move the capital south. In 1790, Washington signed an Act of Congress to establish the federal government in the District of Columbia. The states of Virginia and Maryland donated the areas. George Washington and French urban planner Pierre L'Enfant chose the site for the new presidential home. A competition took place to find a designer. An architect named James Hoban from Ireland won the competition. He proposed a building modeled on a wealthy man's house in Dublin. Today, that building, called Leinster House, is where the Irish Parliament meets. James Hoban originally suggested the house be three stories, but George Washington changed the design to two stories. He was worried the government quarry would not have enough stone for both the president's house and a building for Congress. Work on the house started in 1792. At that time, the building was called by names such as the President's Palace or the Executive Mansion. Its walls were not yet white, but grayish sandstone. George Washington supervised the building project. Yet he and his wife Martha never lived there. The house was completed long after he left office in 1797.
America's second president, John Adams, and his wife, Abigail, were the first to live in the new home. They moved in on November 1, 1800. The inside of the house was still not completed. Abigail Adams was known to have complained about the house's condition. Perhaps luckily for her, John and Abigail Adams lived in the president's house for only 4 months. John Adams lost re-election to Thomas Jefferson that autumn. During the following 8 years, Jefferson tried to finish work on the home. So did the next president, James Madison.
In 1814, British forces invaded Washington. They burned the president's home. President Madison's wife, Dolly, tried to save valuable objects from the fire as she fled. Some say she rescued a painting of George Washington. However, some historians question that story. One way or another, the portrait survived. It is perhaps one of the most well-known images of George Washington. The picture, painted by Gilbert Stuart, hangs in the White House to this day. Here is British Prime Minister David Cameron talking about the fire of 1814.
So I am a little embarrassed, as I stand here, to think that 200 years ago, my ancestors tried to burn this place down. Now, looking around me, I can see you've got the place a little better defended today. You're clearly not taking any risks with the Brits this time.
After the fire, James Hoban helped rebuild the house he had designed. During this time, it was painted white. Some people began referring to the building informally by its color. Finally, in 1901, President Theodore Roosevelt officially named the residence the White House.
Over the years, the White House has been enlarged and almost totally rebuilt. Today, the White House has 132 rooms and 35 bathrooms. There are also 412 doors, 147 windows, 28 fireplaces, 8 staircases, and 3 elevators. The White House has an east wing and a west wing. The Oval Office, the large round room where the president works, is in the west wing. The first family lives in the east wing. In case you were wondering, the official home of the vice president is on the grounds of the Naval Observatory, about 5 kilometers away.
First ladies have all added to the White House in some way. Jacqueline Kennedy, for example, created a colorful garden that is named in her honor. Michelle Obama created one of the largest vegetable gardens. She invited school children to help her plant the vegetables as an educational experience.
Today is getting the soil ready. Then we'll come back in a couple of weeks to actually do the planting. And then sometime in June, right around the time that school is over, hopefully we'll have lots of great vegetables and fruits. We'll harvest them, and then we'll bring you guys into the kitchen in the White House.
Kitchen workers use the vegetables to prepare healthy meals at the White House.
Many presidents have also added features to the White House. For example, in 1979, President Jimmy Carter had solar panels put on the West Wing to use the energy of the sun to heat water. President Franklin Roosevelt had a pool built in 1933. Polio had disabled his legs, but President Roosevelt still swam. During President Richard Nixon's time in office, the old swimming pool was covered and the room was used for the media. The change permitted more space for television camera equipment. The press room was rebuilt in January 2007. The work included a better look for television, a new electrical system, a high-technology communication system, better air conditioning, and more comfortable seats. President George W. Bush reopened the room in a ceremony on July 11, 2007. He joked that the room had been so hot before he lost weight answering questions.
As visitors enter the White House, they see pictures of past presidents on the walls. In another hall on the same floor are paintings of first ladies. A room off this hallway contains a collection of fine dishes. Most presidents have added to this collection. Many first ladies have also followed Jacqueline Kennedy's goal to collect art of the nation's finest artists. Presidents and first ladies have also often invited musicians to perform at the White House. In 2010, the Obamas held a civil rights music night. Here, Yolanda Adams sings, "A Change Is Gonna Come."
Yeah, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's out there far beyond the sky. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Yeah, yeah, yes, it will now.
Wide marble steps lead to the next floor of the White House. It is called the State Floor. Presidents use rooms here for official duties and to entertain guests.
The largest room on the state floor is the East Room. News conferences and music performances take place here. But the room has had other uses over the years. Abigail Adams hung her family's clothes to dry from the wash. Mourners filled the room to view President Abraham Lincoln's body there. And President Obama recently met with wounded warriors in the East Room.
Other rooms on the state floor are named for their colors: the Blue Room, the Green Room, and the Red Room. The president meets with diplomats and other guests in these rooms. They are also used for special events. The 22nd president, Grover Cleveland, married Frances Folsom in the Blue Room in 1886. The Green Room held the body of President Lincoln's son, Willie, who died in 1862 when he was 11 years old. And the 19th president, Rutherford Hayes, took his oath of office in the Red Room. He was sworn in as president in 1877 following a disputed election against Samuel Tilden.
Nearby is the State Dining Room, where big events take place, like official dinners for visiting leaders. It can now seat as many as 140 guests. The Treaty Room on the second floor is used for meetings. Important documents have been signed there. On October 7, 1963, President John F. Kennedy signed a limited nuclear test ban treaty in the room. At different times, the treaty room was the cabinet room or the president's office.
The next floor of the White House contains bedrooms for guests. One of these is the Lincoln bedroom, named for the 16th president. But Abraham Lincoln never slept there. Lincoln used the room as an office while he led the country through the Civil War in the 1860s. President Lincoln was murdered days after the war ended, with the surrender of Robert E. Lee, the Southern general. John Wilkes Booth, a stage actor and supporter of the South, shot Lincoln at Ford's Theater, not far from the White House. Over the years, presidents and other people have suggested seeing Lincoln's ghost or feeling his presence in the White House.
Long gone are the days when people could simply walk into the White House. In fact, the White House was closed to visitors temporarily after the September 11th terrorist attacks in 2001.
Information about White House tours, as well as a virtual tour, can be found at whitehouse.gov.
I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Kelly Jean Kelly. Transcripts and MP3s of our programs are at learningenglish.voanews.com. Join us again next week for This is America with VOA Learning English.